Hi, and welcome to the Movies You Love podcast, the podcast where every few weeks I sit down and I talk with another film lover, film writer, film enthusiast, to talk about a movie that helped them fall in love with movies. And this time around, I got to sit down with Kristen Sales, a writer over at The Movie Mezzanine, which is at moviemezzanine.com. And you can also follow her at Twitter, at SalesOnFilm. She's a great writer, and I got her to sit down and talk about the 1960 classic Hitchcock film, Psycho. And yes, we do make jokes about the remake, which honestly, I don't think I've actually seen the whole of. I remember seeing it on TV when it around the time it came out. But I know for a fact, like in the last decade or so, I've never actively seeked it out. And I'm almost to the point of curious right now that I'm thinking about it, having now rewatched the old Psycho, which is magnificent. But moving on, I've kind of been contemplating a lot of things recently. I've been contemplating doing other podcasts. I've got some ideas, and I don't know what I want to do with it. I've been thinking mainly about how do I get into mainstream radio, and do I want to? Like, I mean, I know Jamaica as a country works very differently than anywhere else, so I'm certain, I'm sure that I have 0% Jamaican listenership on this show. But watching, thinking about what I'm doing on here, I remember being a lot younger, being a teenager, and while this is weird to think of it this way, while I've never been the guy who has his ear peeled to the radio all the while, I always kind of liked the idea of being on a radio, of being a voice coming out through a speaker and someone hearing me and someone connecting with that voice, whether it be that I was talking about the music of the day that I loved, whether it was talking about film. And I think that might just be one of the many things which brought me to podcasting, because that first time I sat down and I listened to a podcast, I'm like, holy shit, this is someone just talking to me from another location entirely, almost unbeknownst to him or her, where I'm like, I think I can do this, and I think I can make this, and I'm kind of happy that I'm doing it this way. But at the same time, god damn, it'd be really cool to work for a radio. It's kind of like all of those journalists working now who, the first time they get published in print, they're like, god damn, it's kind of cool to have to see your name in print, even though the internet is awesome as it is. I've been contemplating, I've been thinking about it. I wonder, do I have the time and the effort to make more shows? I was thinking about a music-based show. I don't know what I'd do. The history of music. Andrew going through the millennia. Now, you guys probably wouldn't want to hear me talk about Bowie or Led Zeppelin, or even discuss the tones of Glenn. of Beck, or discussing stuff like the Glenn Miller Band and how it formed me as a youth listening to music. I don't know. Would you guys want to hear that? I'm completely lost on whether it's worth it. I'll keep it kicking around in the back of my head. Would radio people want to hear it? Would I be able to go on a radio show for 30 minutes a week and be like, hey guys, I want to walk you through the music of The Who, and just kind of blow people's minds away? And at the same time, I almost know for a fact that no one wants it, because I live in Jamaica, where anytime I mention someone who's pre-1991, I kind of get blank looks from people from all ages, pretty much. And I'm like, yeah, I am the weird one. Anyways, guys, moving on into this episode, as I mentioned, Kristen Sales, Movie Mezzanine, at Sales on Film on Twitter. We're talking Psycho, so enjoy, because, guys, be wary of the shower. Be wary of the shower.
Here we have a quiet little motel, tucked away off the main highway, and as you see, perfectly harmless looking, when in fact, it has now become known as the scene of the crime. This motel also has, as an adjunct, an old house, which is if I may say so. A little more sinister looking, less innocent than the motel itself. And in this house, the most dire, horrible events took place. I think we can go inside because the place is up for sale. Although I don't know who's going to buy it now.
Alright, so if we're good to go, I'm just going to jump right in. And I'm going to start out by saying thank you so much for joining me, Kristen. As I'm happy to say, I can't believe it's been over a year of me doing this show and no one has brought up an Alfred Hitchcock film. I'd like to say that you're the first to bring up Alfred Hitchcock, and we are now going to be talking about Psycho today.
I'm proud to rep Alfred Hitchcock. He's my favorite, so...
There was actually a part of my brain yesterday when I was thinking about it and I was going through the email again and I realized that you didn't specify 1960 Psycho, and for a second in my brain I was wondering, she couldn't meet the Gus Van Sant one. She has to meet Alfred. I'm just going to assume Alfred Hitchcock and just ignore it.
See, because I don't like to specify that it's the Hitchcock Psycho, because I don't like to acknowledge that there is another Psycho. I don't even like to acknowledge that there's like Psycho 2 or Psycho 3. Like, to me, it's not a franchise. It's just a single entity in my mind. So, you know, and you were good enough to just take me at my word, I guess. And
I was more thinking to myself, what would have been more entertaining to me? Coming here and being correct, or coming here and being incorrect and having at least 3 minutes go of us kind of just not know what the other one is talking about.
Yeah.
Until someone says Vince Vaughn and we just go, whoa, what's going on?
Yeah, wow. Well, now I'm kind of disappointed that I don't love that movie, so I could just freak people out, and instead of talking about like a masterpiece of cinema, I could just be talking about like Vince Vaughn masturbating, and like I just, you know,
I have not seen that movie in so long. I almost want to watch it now just for the sake of the entertainment value.
No, you don't.
No, I don't. but anyways, let me start at the beginning, where I always try to start with all of these conversations, and ask you to tell me a little bit about the time you actually first saw Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. Yeah. When and where were you? What was going on?
I am so awful at this question because I have the worst memory in the world, and I never remember like when the first time I do something. So I can never remember when it was I met my best friends, or when was the first time I did something that ended up being really memorable. I think the first time I saw the movie was in high school, and I took a sort of film class in high school that was half of the year, and the second half was film production. So the first half, they showed, you know, movies that the teacher had, like, recorded off of, like, AMC and, like, cut out the commercials. You know, it was, like, really DIY and really, like, not very scholarly. But I think that's probably the first time that I saw Psycho, because, and then, like, very shortly after that, I probably got the DVD. And then probably just watched it a lot around the ages of like 15, 16, 17. And then in college, I took a course on Hitchcock. So we watched Psycho, and I was, you know, all really excited and like telling everyone else in the class, like, oh, this is my favorite movie. This is my favorite movie. You gotta come to the lecture where we watch Psycho. And then I was just, you know, like really excited. I had a Norman Bates t-shirt. Actually, that it had a picture of Anthony Perkins as Norman Bates, and then on the top it said Norman Bates, and on the bottom it said One Bad Mother. So it's a Psycho joke, and I would wear it like to every. I wore it to like Psycho Week during the Hitchcock class, like hoping that somebody would be like, "Hey, cool T-shirt," you know. I don't know. And as soon as I saw it, it just like really connected with me, and I just became obsessed with it. And just I have, you know, it's like one of those movies where the visual language of it and the script of it is so just like embedded in my consciousness and my memory. So it's just sometimes the quotes or images from the movie just sort of like come to my consciousness out of nowhere. I have such like a grasp on the language of it. It's just, I don't know. It's like a part of me, and I don't know where that came from or why it is, but I just really, really like this movie.
Did anyone tell you, hey, that is a cool shirt?
Yeah, I think a couple of people did. Well, the cool thing was about that class is that the professor was really awesome, and she was like a huge Hitchcock nerd, and it turned out that she had a Vertigo t-shirt that she wore on Vertigo week, and it made me feel a little bit better about myself. I was like, okay, if this professor has like a nerdy Hitchcock shirt, then I feel better about my nerdy Hitchcock shirt, so that's good, yeah.
A lot of the people who come on this podcast tend to kind of not... I don't want to make you sound out of the ordinary, but most of the people who come on tend to not be coming from an educational standpoint with their love of film. And you are one of the few who have that kind of viewpoint when you're looking at movies. You kind of... You even mentioned that you took a Hitchcock-specific course. Yeah. What do you say to people when you talk about the idea of... in an educational standpoint, discussing film more than just the fan nature of it, of just being like, this is what I love and this is what I want to talk about?
Well, for me, I just come from like an academic background where I always really took to like academia and analyzing things in like a, you know, an analytical way. So I was always just like, you know, I don't want to say like teacher's pet, but I always really liked school, you know, and I liked analyzing things and understanding it through that sort of lens. So, and even, you know, before I had ever like read a book about movies or television or anything, I sort of looked at media critically, even like when I was a kid, which I don't know, it was weird, I guess, but that's just how I viewed it. And then I started to get more into, you know, like film analysis, I guess, when I was like in middle school, because I remember I took a film production class in middle school, and I was like storyboarding things and was just like really into, you know, analyzing things visually. I usually don't have to sort of like defend my viewpoint with people, because I think like my family knows that I look at things very analytically. So like if we talk about movies, if they ask me about a movie, they know I'm going to give them like probably a little more in depth than just like I liked it or I didn't like it. And sometimes they like that, and sometimes they know better just not to ask me at all, because they don't want to get like a half an hour lecture about like framing and sound design. You know, like sometimes they're into that, but sometimes they're just like, okay, Kristen, calm down. I think most of the people that know me know me well enough to either like put up with that aspect of, you know, my love of film, or that's why we're friends, because they like to do that too. In terms of fandom, like I have nothing against fandom. Actually, I really like bringing those two worlds together. It's sort of like academia and also just like fan culture, or just being like really enthusiastic about something. I like combining those two things, and I don't think they're mutually exclusive. So, I mean, and since I ended film school, it's kind of been a more gradual process towards, you know, like just being a fan of things, and then using the sort of the analytical language that I learned in school to sort of meld those two worlds. So, yeah, I mean, it is really common, like you said, to have people just like fall in love with movies when they're a kid and have like more of a like an emotional or like nostalgic attachment to some piece of media that they experienced, like maybe it was like with their family or something. But I always was viewing things in terms of like wanting to analyze it, wanting to know what it was about and who were the people that made it and things like that. So, it's interesting that you bring that up, but, I don't know. I just always think of movies through that lens.
So, you never created, like, I didn't really come from an academic point of view when it came to film analysis or film discussion. It's something that I slowly kind of battle with trying to kind of remain the fan lover that I am of things, and at the same time trying to engage the more analytical discussion that's going on with film today, through the internet or otherwise. And yeah. I find myself more and more these days creating that filter of not breaking into the analytical version of myself when it comes to film discussion when I'm around certain people, even certain friends of mine, where they know that I'm a film lover and that I do this kind of thing, but at the same time, I kind of tone it down because I know that they're going to be, like how you say, they're going to either become the person who puts up with or kind of gets annoyed and refuses to ask in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I find it interesting that you skip that filter point in your life. And I'm curious if you ever found it difficult to not have the filter, because I'm sure you know many people who do.
No, not really, because it's... I think... Because to me, it's not necessarily about, like, standing up behind a lectern and giving a lecture. To me, like, critical analysis of film is could be as easy as if somebody asks you, like, I saw Guardians of the Galaxy the other day. So if somebody asked me, you know, a friend of mine, like, what did you think of that movie? I would pick, you know, like, one aspect of the movie that I thought was a little bit more in depth than just, like, it was good or bad. And then just say that and then expound upon, like, how that one aspect impacted, like, my perception of the movie. And to me, like, film analysis is as simple as, like, you know, one or two or three sentences. And then you can give, and then that person that you're talking to, like, might think about the movie in a different way. You know, if the only comment you give on a movie is, you know, I thought that the way that they staged the action was not as successful as the way that some of the still character moments were, then maybe they start to think of the movie through a different lens than they had, and it brings some sort of, like, new insight, you know, to that movie. So to me, I don't think it's I don't think of it as a, you know, a demonstrative kind of thing. I think about it more as, like, this is how I look at movies, and if you want to ask my opinion on it, I'm gonna tell you. Because there's so many people that will say, you know, I didn't like the characters, or I thought it was funny, or I thought it was too slow. Like, yeah, all of those things may be true, but those are not the observations that I'm interested in. You know, I'm interested in something that's a little, something that I noticed, you know, that is more unique. So it's never been, like, a problem. Like, I've never had somebody say, like, wow, you're a real pretentious asshole, you know? Like, I'm not gonna talk to you anymore.
It's not about pretension, because I don't really think that's it. Even though I do agree. I think there are a certain contingent of people who might take it that way. I don't really think it's about pretension. But
well, I don't either. But I mean,
I think it's that I have this feeling in me that if I go 100% down the rabbit hole that I would normally do when I'm having conversations like this. Or, like, writing something for a website when I'm writing a column and I'm trying to be as in-depth and as critical and as close to the bullet as I can be. I feel a lot of people are going to be lost down that rabbit hole as opposed to kind of following along with me because it almost feels to the point where you're getting into knowledge that they're not sharing with you. You're not sharing perfectly with them. Or they're not.
Yeah, I understand that impulse, but my job as a writer, if I'm writing a column, is to communicate that information, or to just lay it out and have the faith in people that they, if they're interested in what I'm saying, and it sparks some sort of, you know, a wanting in them, that they'll go and research that thing. So sometimes, you know, I'll talk about media in terms of, like, other media it reminds me of. So I'm especially interested in films that have references or are been impacted by other visual arts, you know, like painting or sculpture or things like that. So sometimes I'll think about a movie in terms of what other art pieces it's referencing or it's building upon, It's not, if people don't know about those pieces, like, everything I write is on the internet. So I'm assuming if you're on the internet, you're either going to take the 5 seconds it takes to Google and learn about that, or or you're not. So it's, but I think that it, I just like to have a little more, like, faith in people that if they don't have to understand it all the time, because I read analysis of movies all the time where there are references to, you know, like, philosophers or critical theory that I haven't read or I don't know about. But if the writer is clear enough in what they're communicating, either I'm going to get the gist of it or I'm going to open a new tab and find out what they're talking about so that I could better understand, you know, what they're writing about. To me, it's not, I'm not worried about people, not understanding, because I think that if people are interested, if they're curious, then they're going to go all the way with you.
That is also very true. So pulling it back to Psycho, as I have tried to tangent completely right there, talking about more about that first time that you saw this movie in high school, no less, I'm kind of curious, what was it about the world of Psycho that drew you in so much that first time, if you can recall?
Yeah, that's something that I've really tried to go back and think about. I don't know. I can only speculate from the position I'm in right now and sort of go back to, like, you know, my 15-year-old self. Like, what would it be that captivated me? And I think one of the things that I still like about Psycho, and that might have been the thing that drew me in when I was younger, is that literally and figuratively, it's a very black and white movie. And there are, and Hitchcock movies, I guess, you know, are famously sort of Freudian and psychoanalytic. So, and to me, as a teenager, I think that I was sort of really drawn to the sort of psychoanalysis viewpoint of things, because it's kind of an intro to philosophy kind of thing. It's kind of easy for people to understand, or it's easy for me to understand. And it's very much in terms of, like, you know, actions and its opposite reactions. So there's not a lot of, you know, gray area in psychoanalytics, and certainly not in Psycho, because the, you know, the costuming is very black and white in terms of, you know, like what Marion Crane is wearing, and then obviously it's shot in black and white. And there are a lot of good and bad actions. So some people are doing good things, or some, more often than not, people are doing bad things, but they come across as good, quote unquote, good people. And so what is that sort of dynamic, and how is that muddled, and how is Hitchcock communicating these sort of variations in people's, you know, natures? And to me, that was, like, really that was really interesting, because I think whatever kind of media I was watching at the time, which was mostly probably television, some movies, but mostly television, characterizations weren't that they weren't that complicated. So mostly people would be one thing or the other, and you wouldn't really understand that they could be both good or bad, and do good and bad things. Or I wouldn't really understand how I could have empathy for, you know, a serial killer, how I could identify with someone who's making very different decisions than I would, but I still like them, and I can still like them even after they've died and they're no longer on screen. So to me, it was very fascinating the way in which Hitchcock sort of manipulates the viewer to identify with different characters throughout the movie, and how you can identify with multiple characters at the same time, even when their motivations and are conflicting. So to me, that's one of the aspects of Psycho that is still really fascinating for me, and how I can like everybody in the movie, even though they are doing maybe despicable things, and their goals are, you know, sort of against each other within the actual diegesis of the movie, but I can still really empathize and root for them at the same time, which to me is just, like, really interesting, and I don't know how he does it.
If we all knew how we did it, how he did it, there'd be a lot more movies like this.
Yeah, I think so.
But it's kind of weird you talking about the idea of liking everyone in this movie to some effect. When I sit there and I'm like, I definitely do not like, I can't remember his character name at that point, the guy who, in the beginning of the movie, gives out the $40,000.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean,
hate him. But yeah, I'm just being funny at this point. I'm not really sure.
I agree with you. Actually, that's, like, really important, because obviously you don't like that character. But the more but there is an aspect to that performance that I really like, you know? And I really like how sort of, like, sleazy he is and how good that actor is at doing that. So to me, like, it brings up the conflicting emotions of being like, oh, this character is, like, really, you know, like, offensive to me. And yet he makes me laugh. And I like his interactions with the other people. And I like his, like, weird cowboy hat, you know? And so there are, like, I do have, like, positive feelings towards that actor and the performance and the way that that character is written and incorporated into the movie, even though he's a total, you know, scumbag. And the more I watch it, the more I like those scenes, you know, or the minor characters or, like, the one line reading that they have, which is, like, really entertaining to me. Like, I just, like, really focus on those moments. And, you know, even though, like, the shower scene is the most famous, sometimes I just think about, like, the one line reading that the town sheriff has, like, really late in the movie, and I'll think about it and it'll just make me laugh, you know. And I don't know, those little moments of it, like, when you've watched the movie so many times, you just come to, like, really feel affection towards those small moments that maybe have, like, nothing to do with anything.
Talking about small moments, which feel kind of weird for this movie, because the truth of the matter is that this movie is kind of so famous for what it is and what it does, that I almost feel that it's one of those cases for me where everyone will know certain things, but there are points where I feel it weird that no one talks about these moments. And I kind of find the only movie in my head that I can think of that kind of fits this bill other than this is 2001: A Space Odyssey, where everyone talks about Hal, but no one talks about the monkeys somehow. I feel less and less people know about those monkeys when they go into 2001, and that's kind of weird. But for this movie, I kind of found it weird, because this is probably the third or fourth time I'm watching it ever, and thank you for reminding me I need to rewatch this movie. It's the exact end of this movie, when finally Norman Bates is caught. We finally find out that he's playing dual roles of his mother, and his mother's really dead, blah, blah, blah. And we get this, like, suddenly that almost feels like the real end of the movie, and then we get this ending scene where we have a psychiatrist explain to us the whole psychological aspect of this movie that I'm kind of curious to ask you about. As someone who's a diehard Psycho lover, like, I almost felt like this was an unnecessary scene to some effect. Like,
yeah, well, I mean, a lot of the analysis of Psycho and a lot of writing about it brings up that exact point. That if there is a weakness in the film, then it's that scene where the psychiatrist explains everything. To me, I don't mind it, and I mind it even less considering that it came out in 1960, and that I feel like instead of just shocking the audience and showing something that might be, like, you know, sort of prurient and sensational, and they have to sort of explain what actually is going on with Norman, because the movie builds up so much sympathy for him in the beginning, and then when you know that he, you know, dresses up like his mother, like, an audience that doesn't have the sort of understanding that we do now might just say, like what the cop says, that he's, like, a transvestite or, you know, some sort of, like, weird pervert or something. So they, you know, they want to explain not only to the characters, to Sam and Lila, but also to, like, a 1960s audience that would say, like, oh, it's not that he is, like, some sort of, like, sicko. It's that he has this, like, really, really damaged psyche. So they're kind of, to me, it makes sense, because that scene is sort of reinstating the kind of sympathy that you have for Norman in the beginning part of the movie, that any that might have been damaged by the very traumatic scene of Lila finding the mother and the fruit seller and stuff. And what I think is more important is that that scene of Simon Oakland as the psychiatrist sort of explaining away his behavior is not the end of the movie. The end of the movie is you go out of that, you know, room where the psychiatrist is and walk down the hall, and the cop gives the blanket to Norman, who is now being voiced by the mother. And you have, you know, the famous line that, you know, I wouldn't even hurt a fly. And it's, but it's a voiceover. So it's the, it's, kind of a, you're taking the reality aspect of the movie, and Hitchcock is giving you something that's completely subjective for the audience, because Norman's not talking. He's not moving his lips. You're hearing the voiceover of his mother persona. And, you know, so it's totally explanatory and subjective, but also very, very creepy, because it's taking an aspect of Norman's, damaged, you know, psychological self and putting you inside of that. And then the second to last shot where it's, Norman's, close up, and then it's superimposed, with the skull, with the mother's skull. So there's a skull over Norman's face, and then it cuts to, them pulling out, the Marion's white car from the swamp. And so it's just sort of reminding you that, you know, there are other bodies there. So I understand sort of a modern audience's reticence towards believing like that scene actually needs to be in there. But I don't know. I like it. And I also find it really funny, sort of retrospectively in 2014, I find that explanation to be kind of hilarious, because it is so kind of dumb. And then also like, Sam's sort of total revulsion and horror, like, why was he wearing that thing? Like, to me, like, he just, that character, like, he's such like a masculine kind of just guy. And he just like doesn't understand any variation in like gender identity or psychology. He like doesn't understand, and it's really it's simultaneously like really funny for him to be like so revolted by that, and also very like deeply sad, because these characters just like walked into something, just like the audience did. They just walked into something that they had no idea even existed at all in the world, and it's just like totally, you know, shattering for them.
Is it sad now that I'm imagining a week forward in the world of Psycho, in which Sam is still trying to figure out why he was wearing the dress? Probably trying on dresses and going, like, let me see how this works out.
Yeah, he's probably having nightmares. You know, he probably is just, like, very deeply disturbed by this experience that he had. And he only experienced it secondhand, you know? And it's like, and to me, it's, that scene is both very funny, but extremely darkly funny, because Lila, for her part, doesn't give a shit about whether Norman Bates is schizophrenic or anything. She just wants to know if her sister's dead. And the psychiatrist is so sort of like up his own butt with his psychiatry that he's like not giving, you know, Lila the straight answer that she needs. And then, so he kind of says, oh yeah, yeah, your sister's definitely dead. Like, he just doesn't have the tact to actually, or the sympathy to say, like, oh, I'm, to realize that it's more important for these people, like, the human aspect of it is more important than the theory aspect of it. So that to me is, like, a really dark, dark humor moment. Yeah.
Earlier, you kind of talked about the black and white nature of this film, talking about the good and evil, the dichotomy within this film. And it's something that I don't even know if this is worth noting as an element of the movie, to kind of go a little bit deeper, a little bit more analytical into what's going on in this movie. But talking specifically about Janet Leigh's character, in the beginning of the movie, in the opening scene, which once again, a scene no one talks about, when we meet her in the hotel with Sam, we see her wearing predominantly white clothing. Yeah. She goes back to her boss. That's when she takes the money. But we don't see that decision occur until later on when we see her in black clothing.
Yeah.
And then the movie continues where she remains in that dark clothing. Towards her end, the shower scene, we see her making that decision to return and to do all things better. And that's when she enters the shower, when she's literally washing away all of these bad elements of her character. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of, these are little moments in the movie where I feel that person in me going, I saw something, but I don't know if it's real. And I feel it's really interesting to kind of wonder how far you can take that sort of analytical thinking into something so minute as costume selection in a movie like this.
Oh, well, in a movie like this, knowing Hitchcock and how much he... And actually, and also the screenwriter of this movie, Joseph Stefano, was in psychoanalysis when he was writing the script or right before, dealing with issues that he had with his own mother. And I feel like that's probably one of the reasons that he got the job to write the script, because he knew, Hitchcock knew that he would deliver a script that is very deeply psychoanalytic and has a lot of symbolism. And a lot of Hitchcock movies of this period have that sort of thing. I mean, you talk about Vertigo, that thing's like a, just like a Freudian shit show. And this thing, I don't think that it's taking it too far, just knowing the kind of filmmaker that Hitchcock was, and especially how important costuming was for him, and his character, and especially his female characters. Going back to Vertigo is a huge example of that. But I definitely think that the white lingerie going to the black lingerie going to the, you know, the literally cleansing herself of her sins in that scene. And also when she changes her car, she goes from, a darker car to a pure white car. And all of these kind of like transitional, moments are they're not telegraphed in a really obvious way. So if you watch it the first time or even the first couple times, it might not even come to your mind. But I think they're definitely, purposeful and legitimate. And, when Hitchcock was talking with, Truffaut in that famous interview, they talk about these things specifically, and he says, oh yeah, that's totally on purpose. And, you know, that's to symbolize this and this and this. So I think that not all filmmakers maybe have that level of consciousness in terms of, or purposefulness in terms of like what they, the elements that they put into their movies. But with this movie, absolutely. You could write a whole book on her underwear changes, basically.
So one of the most famous scenes, we talked about it a lot so far, that this movie is constantly referenced for, is the shower scene. Okay. But I find it very weird that personally watching this movie, every time I watch it, the moment that I always gravitate towards is the death of the private investigator.
Yeah.
That's
the kill that people don't talk about. And so if you've never seen the movie before, yeah, you know what's going to happen in the shower, but you do not know what's going to happen to Arbogast when he walks up the stairs, which makes that scene more startling, you know?
It's kind of the way it's put together. I mean,
yeah.
He's walking up the stairs and you already know something is going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. You can already feel it. You can feel the horror mojo of this movie happening. And then the camera switches to this overhead, and the mother comes out. At that point, we still don't know that Norman Bates is the mother. The mother comes out, and the way Hitchcock films a fall is kind of unique and kind of special. But I'm curious to talk to you about, like, what if you had to pick one scene, sans the shower, if that happens to be it, what would be the scene that you would kind of use to kind of show people how unique this movie is and like how it worked for you as a viewer?
Yeah, well, the most important scene in the movie is the sequence right after Marion is killed, because one of the most famous things about this movie is that her character is killed off. The main character is killed off 40 minutes into the movie. But Hitchcock has done such an amazing job of building up identification with Marion that when those ties are severed, it's extremely traumatic. But then the trick of the movie is, for me, and where its greatest success lies, is in that very critical, you know, like 7 minute period where Norman comes back down, sees the crime scene, and cleans up the office. And we're in there with him the entire time that that happens. So, and it's totally wordless, and conveyed through Anthony Perkins' body languages and the way that Hitchcock frames, you know, Norman in the doorway, and how he uses the mop, and how he, you know, very dutifully cleans the sink and the tub, and he, you know, gets the shower curtain down, she's pulled the shower curtain down, but the way that he wraps her in the shower curtain, and there is, I think it's a continuous shot where Hitchcock reminds us of what turns out to be the least important element in the film, which is kind of the red herring of the movie, which is the $40,000 that she's wrapped in the newspaper. And I think, if I remember correctly, the camera goes, you know, all around the hotel room, going from, you know, like her suitcase that Norman packs up to, you know, the bed and the lamp and all these things. And then it dollies into, the newspaper that's sitting on the bedstand. So, sort of consciously creating this desire for either the money to be discovered or for something to happen with the money. Is Norman going to take the money? Is it going to become a crime of profit instead of crime of passion? And then the kicker of that scene is where Norman goes back into the hotel and looks around and then finally finds the money in the newspaper. And then he's put everything into the trunk of Marion's car, and he's grabbed the newspaper, and he looks around, and he just casually tosses the newspaper into the back of the trunk because he doesn't know that the money is there. So that scene is creating so much tension surrounding that money. And then sort of the sick joke of that scene, which is one of the sick jokes of the entire movie, is that the money is completely useless. He never knows that there's money there. And Marion's, the entire impetus for her to run away and get a new life, you know, with Sam, her theft of the money is totally meaningless, has nothing to do with anything. Pointless. Her death was pointless. It's just so sick, and it just makes you feel sick. It's like there's no point for her to have died.
And it's literally a series of random events.
Yeah, it is. But the way that Hitchcock shoots it is to make you feel that sort of the kind of twisted irony of it is that, you know, maybe in a more conventional crime drama it would be about the money. And then that joke continues throughout the whole rest of the movie, because the only reason that the Arbogast is hired is to get the money back. They don't think that Marion's dead. They have no idea that a whole another world of, you know, twisted psychology and killers could possibly be here, because everyone is fixated on the fact that it's $40,000. It needs to be recovered. You know, maybe she's in trouble, but that entire second half plays upon the viewer's knowledge of the fact that the reason that they're investigating has already been, it's already been branded meaningless, and the money's in the swamp, and there's no point. So it really kind of just ratchets up that sort of tension, because you know that all of this investigation is, you know, they're looking in the wrong places. And it's just, to me, and that scene, getting back to Norman, is there's something about the way, the very thorough job that he does cleaning that up, and the shot reverse shot of him sinking the car, and then it sort of stops in the swamp for a minute, and he gets kind of nervous and looks around, and then it cuts back and the car sinks and he kind of smiles. In that scene, you want the car to sink. It's like, you were just rooting for Marion to get away and go back and give the money back and, like, you know, start fresh. And then, like, you know, 10 minutes later, you're rooting for this guy who just cleaned up her murderer. And if you know that he is her murderer, you know that, you know, he's a very sick guy, but you're rooting for him to succeed in his covering up of this crime. So to me, like, just the way that Hitchcock so thoroughly switches your identification from one character to another and then sustains that interest for, you know, the rest of the movie for another hour is, like, the glue that puts that movie together. Because if that scene between the murder right after the shower scene had not worked, nobody would care about this movie. They would call it a complete failure because they would say, oh, he kills off his lead actress and, you know, after 40 minutes, and then the rest of the movie doesn't work. But because that part does work, it's a masterpiece.
I was thinking about it really closely watching this movie again, and there is a piece of this movie which I feel is kind of strange, and it's the one tiny moment of when Janet Leigh sees her boss while she's driving off with the money.
Mm-hmm.
And something about that moment in the movie kind of almost makes it start to feel as though the movie has entered the dream world, where she is now fantasizing about the idea of taking the money and running, right? And almost every element of this movie leading up to her final death in the movie, and then the scene you're talking about when you see Norman Bates cleaning up, every element of that almost feels like we could have had a moment when it just pulls us back. It just pulls us right back and goes, this was all a dream. She was just thinking about the idea, and she came to this conclusion, and she realized this is a bad idea. And I don't
yeah,
know. If,
yeah. I agree with you. Yeah.
It's. I mean, moving from seeing the boss, where you have that long driving scene where she's imagining all of the things that are going on back in her world that she's left, to seeing the police officer who has that look, the way that he's shot. He kind of just looks down on you with that face where you're like, how is this real? To to changing out the car with that kind of awkward scene. Like, everything leading up feels like this could be a dream.
Well, you're right, because obviously, getting back to the first part where she begins to imagine the voiceover for the people. And I actually made a mistake earlier when I was talking about how when you hear the mother voiceover at the very end of the film, that is a unique experience. And I had totally forgotten the fact that you hear Marion's imagined voiceover for that very long sequence. So actually those are, you know, connected, and you already are very comfortable with the fact that you're hearing someone's thoughts projected to you, and not in dialogue, but in voiceover. And absolutely, that there is a dreamlike quality to that sequence, because I think she's asleep. So there is kind of a rhythm of her driving, which is already very hypnotic, the way that the light's changing and it's getting dark, and then she does pull over to go to sleep. So you're right. If she went in that shot, that very jarring shot where the cop pulls up and she wakes up, it's very possible that could have been, you know, her still asleep. And the reason that the shot of the policeman is so unsettling is because he's the only character whose eyes you don't see, and because he's wearing those very dark glasses. And a lot of one of the most prominent themes of the movie is seeing and looking and voyeurism. And there's a lot of mentions in dialogue to eyes and to looking. And the policeman has none of that. The policeman is totally impenetrable. And it's very, very creepy because he's the only person. You just get the sense that he is just like this eternal force of just of the law, really, which is what Hitchcock was the most afraid of, personally, was, you know, a policeman in jail and in a larger sense of being judged and punished. And that sequence of when the cop follows her, and it's, again, it's a masterful use of shot, reverse shot, because you're looking, she's looking in her rearview mirror, and then it goes back to the shot, and the cop is still following her at a distance. And then finally, when that tension's released, when the policeman pulls off, you know, on the off-ramp. And, but then when he comes back later, when she goes to get the, when she goes to get the used car, it's just like so, it's so unsettling. Just the tension that, you know, what if she gets busted? What's going to happen with the policeman? Like what? And, when she's getting the used car, that the whole way that that sequence is framed is all of those men just like looking at her. Looking at her car, looking at her body, looking at her purse and her money, and it's just like, it's just almost too much to bear. It's just all of those eyes looking at her and sort of like judging her, not being sure what her motivations are, and then her visible discomfort at having the, you know, the mechanic, and then that's the way that they're lined up sort of in a row, the three of them, the used car salesman, the mechanic, and the policeman, just kind of like watching her drive away. It's very it's creepy, it's unsettling.
I'm kind of curious, with the years you spent with this film, not just loving it but dissecting it and kind of piecing it together, as Hitchcock put himself, what is it that when you kind of find yourself pushing someone towards this movie, do you find yourself hoping they'll come away with the most?
That's a good question. I think one of the most immediate impacts of the movie is not only how scary it is, but not scary in a, I think, in an immediate way. There are some visceral scares in the movie, but to me, it is more of a building of atmosphere. Like some of those shots that I mentioned, with the three guys lined up, or with the policeman, or with Norman sort of eating the candy corn. There are just all of these like really sort of uncanny moments where you feel uncomfortable, but you don't know why. And I would hope that anybody watching this for the first time, they would first of all just experience it straight, not try to be over analytic about it, but then watch it a second time and go back and try to make the invisible visible. So to try to like understand that, the ways in which that framing and cutting and costume design and you know, shot reverse shot or the way in which that Arbogast's death is filmed are there to make you feel a certain way, you know, that they're purposeful. The way that Hitchcock goes from following Arbogast up the stairs to a, you know, a bird's eye view above, where you watch the action in a single shot. In this single shot, you watch Mother come out and then stab him, and then it cuts right to his face with the blood over his eye. Like the way in which it's put together is to make you feel certain things. So I would first like just advise people to feel it, and then to go back and say like, wow, the way that the visual grammar of this is set up and the way that it's written and the genius of the performances are all contributing to the initial emotional response that I had. And because to me, analyzing this movie, like, doesn't lessen the emotional impact it has on me. Like, if anything, it makes it deeper, and it makes my appreciation of the craft behind it even more intense. But it's like, even when I watch it and I'm conscious of certain choices that Hitchcock is making, there's still an element and a level that's just enjoying it as a, like, a perverse, you know, carnival-esque kind of movie, like a haunted house movie almost, like a very ghoulish sort of creepy Saturday afternoon matinee type movie, you know?
I'm curious. I'm assuming, being a resident of Pasadena, that you've had the opportunity to see this on the big screen at some point.
Yeah, I have. I saw it. I saw it in a lecture hall in a theater in college, and then I've seen it on the big screen twice, I think. What? It was probably at the Egyptian theater, but. Yeah, it's incredible, and it doesn't matter what size audience I watch it with, if it's, you know, my immediate family or if it's 300 people in another movie theater, they always react audibly and viscerally to the scares of the movie. So you can go around and look at people sort of cringing during the shower scene or shifting in their seat during the conversation that Norman and Marion have, you know, in the parlor that's very creepy and has all of these, and like the nervous laughter that people have during that scene, or the nervous laughter that they have at the end of the scene when the psychiatrist is explaining it all. Like, it doesn't, this movie's like, what, 54 years old, and it doesn't have any less it hasn't been diminished at all by time, I think. And I think that the perfect visual image that this movie conjures is in my mind is somebody with watching something with their hand in front of their face, like with the fingers splayed out, like just watching it between their fingers, because to me that is just the perfect idea of this movie, which is showing you something that you want to see but you're scared to see. And you're just sort of watching it through your fingers, like half watching it, like being kind of like bunched up in your seat, like, oh God, what's going to happen? But there's also like a real thrill in that, in seeing something that's sort of horrific, you know? That's why to me it's like the perfect horror movie, because it has that sense of like macabre fun, but it's also like very deeply sad as well as entertaining.
And I remain infinitely jealous because you get to see films like this in a theater. but, alright, this is just an afterthought that just kind of came to my mind, because as I keep talking about films on this podcast with everyone, and people who tend to come up with films like you, who came up with Psycho, who tend to come up with movies that we, as a community, have kind of decided are masterpieces, and we don't want them touched, but somehow in the Hollywood machine, they continue to be touched. And this film in particular has been touched many times. There is the Psycho remake, and there is even the film that came out a couple years ago, which I still have yet to see, the Anthony Hopkins Hitchcock movie, which discusses making of Psycho. And I don't know if you've seen either of these films, but I'm kind of curious, like, does it bother you at all to see films like this, or specifically this film, touched in any way? Does it affect your conversation you have about this film with people?
No, absolutely not. It bothers me because the strength of this movie on its own is so powerful that to me there's nothing you could do to take away its impact or its integrity as a movie. And there are a lot of people who really enjoy the sequels too, the one Psycho 2 and Psycho 3, and sort of the continued mythology of Norman Bates as a character. And also there's the Bates Motel TV show that's on, which I haven't seen. But I mean, to me, no, that doesn't denigrate the original. It doesn't lessen it. I think that the fact that people continue to be intrigued by Norman Bates is a testament to how powerful the first movie is. And I will say that Hitchcock movie with Anthony Hopkins is horrific. mostly, though, just because of its deep inaccuracies in terms of the making of the movie and the characterization of Hitchcock as a person and a director. But it doesn't, you know... It would bother me if that movie was the only idea that anyone had of what Hitchcock was like or what Psycho is. But the fact is that movie is not that great, and it's not going to stand the tests of time the way that the movies that Hitchcock actually made will. So I think that it's this movie's best defense is just how good it is. And I don't think that Hitchcock is going anywhere in terms of critical acclaim or popularity. I think that his movies and Psycho, which to me is his masterpiece, but that's arguable. I think that they, you know, are eternal in terms of that. And there's nothing really that you could do or say that would change my mind about that.
Am I allowed to say that North by Northwest is the better one?
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
I'm allowed. I'm good.
Well, to me, because that's my, I always say though that Psycho is my favorite movie and it's my favorite Hitchcock movie, but I have no idea if it's the best Hitchcock movie because to me,
I kind of hate to put the words like best in the conversation because I agree with you. I don't think we can definitely qualitatively say this one better than other one. But I mean, yeah, I'm just really jibing you, Kristen. I'm not really looking for you to oust me or to agree with me in that the fact that I like North by Northwest better.
Yeah, because on some days I like, you know, other, because every time I watch North by Northwest, I'm just like, how is this movie so good? Like, it's just so good and so entertaining. So, I mean, the thing about Hitchcock is like, maybe like when I'm watching whatever Hitchcock movie I'm watching, that's my favorite Hitchcock movie. Do you know what I mean? Because they're all like so well made and so of such high quality. But something about Psycho, I think to me is like it gets me, or there's some sort of personal attraction to the material that makes it, you know, my favorite. But I think that almost anybody that says that a Hitchcock movie is their favorite movie, I'm going to be okay with that. You know, like I'm going to say like, yeah, I get you. I understand you. You're probably a good dude.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming and talking with me, Kristen.
Yeah. Thank you, Andrew. It was really fun.
So yeah, that was kind of a fantastic episode. If you haven't seen Psycho, I apologize. And I recommend highly that you actually go and watch that movie because it's great. Otherwise, I don't really have anything else so much to mention. As always, thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, I want you guys to do this. Do this for me. Do it for the Movies You Love crew, even though it's a crew of one, unless we call the entire of Microsoft part of my crew who does Skype. Go out there and go and subscribe to the show in iTunes. Go and rate it, go and review it, and it will be nice to see those things happen because, I mean, I'm not kidding. I'm a vain person. I'd love to see it. I'd love to get that sort of validation. But anyways, thank you so much for listening. As always, go and check out Christian Sales' work over at moviemezzanine.com. Go and follow her on Twitter at SalesOnFilm, and go and... You can hear this podcast all over the place through Stitcher, iTunes, or over at gmanreviews.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at gmanreviews. So thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful day.